Welcome to Midday. I'm Tom Hall here in Studio A. If you began your Passover celebration last night, we wish you Chag Pesach Sameach. Today on Midday, my guest is Baltimore State's attorney Ivan Bates. A poll last fall by the Sarah T. Hughes Center at Goucher College found Ivan Bates to be Baltimore's most popular local official, with 57% of respondents approving of his job performance. He was an outspoken critic of some of the juvenile justice reform measures the Maryland General Assembly passed back in 2022. Lawmakers revised some of that legislation in this year's session, and his call for more parental accountability when juveniles break the law was met with both a chorus of approval and some harsh criticism. All of this has played out with a backdrop of public disagreements with Baltimore Mayor Brandon Scott. At the heart of the dispute is the state's attorney's citation docket. That's a way of adjudicating people who commit low-level crimes like loitering or disorderly conduct and possessing a small amount of drugs. The idea is to find an alternative to incarceration that diverts them to services while holding them accountable for these so-called quality of life crimes. State's Attorney Bates has suggested publicly that the police have not been referring enough cases to the citation docket and that the mayor has not been insisting that they do. The mayor and the state's attorney met last week for the first time in a long time and vowed to meet regularly from now on to clear the air and forge a more productive partnership. State's Attorney Ivan Bates joins me today in Studio A. Welcome back. Always good to see you.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm glad to be here. I hope you're having a great day.
We are, and we are grateful to all of the listeners who've been making sustaining membership pledges to our station. We appreciate that. But we're delighted to have you here because we got to ask you, what's going on with you and the mayor? What's the deal?
You know, I think, you know, we talked about it. You know, sometimes people just don't, like any relationship, sometimes you don't always see eye to eye. And you just have to sometimes just sit down and talk and just air out all the grievances. We had that opportunity to have a frank, open discussion about a number of things. And, you know, only thing I can do, I can always own my part. And, you know, you kind of know when you're wrong when my father calls me to tell me I'm wrong and I need to get myself together. With that call, I clearly recognized just how wrong I was. And so, you know, when we talk about parental accountability, I don't think it ever ends. But at the end of the day, the mayor and
I. So what did Dad have to say about it?
He just said, I don't know what you're doing. Hey, boy, I don't know what you're doing, but this pissing contest you and the mayor are in, you need to end it right now. I mean, that's more or less what he said. And then I think he was 1,000% correct. At the end of the day, you know, I'm very, very passionate about this job. I feel like I'm on a clock. Because these jobs are finite time period that I can do the things that I promise the citizens. And I allow my passion to get in the way of me being able to do the job the proper way. And with that, I think you can only learn from that and from those situations. I think at the end of the day, it's like any relationship. You have to make sure you have really good communication. And I only can look at myself in the mirror to say I could have done better. I don't like to look at what other people did to blame other people. I like to say, what did I do wrong to fix this situation?
Now, you have endorsed his opponent, Sheila Dixon. Uh-huh. She and you have expressed a lot of concern about how the citation docket is working. This is something you campaigned on, something you promised voters. How's it supposed to work? What was your vision, your aspiration for it when you established?
Well, a couple of things. One of the things we saw, the individual who had the job before I did was not holding anyone accountable for quality of life crimes. So let's say it's not a loitering or trespass. Let's say it's an individual who the police watch purchase drugs and then they stop them. In their pocket are 4 vials of crack cocaine. What are we going to do? We're going to just let that person walk away. We're going to steer that person. We're going to lock that person up. We've seen the war on drugs. I don't think it's been successful. But let's give that individual a citation. They come to a citation court, and they're offered the opportunity for drug treatment. And a lot of times, you know, that drug treatment, 5 hours community service, drug treatment, and we're steering that individual into that treatment, into that course right there, whether it's loitering, whether it's trespass, whether it's someone destroying someone's property, whether it's someone that's stolen something underneath $1,000. We're giving the services, but also the community support, the community service as well. You're out there, you're loitering, you're trespass. Ms. Johnson's afraid to walk past you and your group of friends that are sitting out there. she wants to on her way to church. You're standing out there. She feels intimidated and she can't go to church. Hey, you know what? Here's the citation. You can give some community service. You can clean up the neighborhood. And now Ms. Johnson sees you working in the community. Now there's understanding, okay, who these young people are, who Ms. Johnson is. And once again, you're giving something positive to the community. I'm a real big believer of community service. Community service helps you understand the community that you're servicing and allows the community to see that you're also invested.
So that's the accountability part.
That's the accountability part.
What about the accountability of the police department? The police have to refer these cases to the citation document or docket, and it appears that you think they're just simply not doing that, at least as frequently as they should be.
Well, exactly. I think there's a lot of confusion. I think some of the confusion was, one, what all the citations that they could possibly write. Number two, they are always saying, oh, we got to give a warning for everything. You don't have to give a warning if you find an individual drugs in their pocket. You don't have to give a warning if you receive a call for theft, for shoplifting. You don't have to give a warning if someone's destroyed a house or a door, a front door, or something like that. Now, the loitering and trespass, okay, there is a warning. But on one hand, we're hearing the police need to give 3-4 warnings. And now, on another hand, they only need to give one warning. So it was a lot of confusion. The police said that, hey, you know, we wrote the citations, but they didn't even write them legally sufficient. So what we did is we put together what we call a cheat sheet to go ahead and give the police the verbiage to use, and they still weren't writing the citations.
So legally sufficient. This does seem to be a problem because sometimes there are dozens and dozens of them written, but only a few are accepted as legally sufficient. So can you give us an example of how a police officer could write something up that's legally insufficient?
Well, they could sit down, they could write and say, hey, you were trespassing on such and such day, such and such time, not have the date, not have the time, not have the location, not have what the legal standard is in terms of what loitering is. You know, we now have given them a sheet that they can just go ahead and copy, and that's what it is. And, you know, it's very frustrating also because other police entities are using it. University of, I think the University of Maryland, if I'm not mistaken, I know the police, the MTA police. So we have other groups, other organizations are using it. We've been training. That's the other thing. We had been training all the other organizations in the city, but Baltimore City Police Department, for whatever reason, we weren't communicating. And now my prosecutor, Ms. Patricia Deros, has the opportunity to go and train the police about how to do this. But once again, also, I'm not trying to make excuses, but I do recognize that the police really hadn't gotten out the cars to write citations in about 7-8 years. So there's that process of getting around to do it. Our goal is not to give the police more to do, but to make sure you're not just arresting, so you're making an arrest for a quality of life crime. That's not what anybody really wants to see. People want to see the behavior stop, but they want to see it done in a way that individuals have the opportunity to have resources and services, but they do not have that criminal history. And that's what we're trying to do.
The mayor has mentioned that when you mentioned the warnings, the mayor has said that sometimes the police are giving warnings instead of issuing citations because that's better on a number of different levels, including its capacity to satisfy the consent decree. The consent decree, you know, has dramatically changed the way policing is conducted in our city for the better, you know, as most people would assess it. So what about that point that, you know, sometimes even a citation is too far to go given the history of policing in the city and the literal orders of the consent decree to cut it out?
Well, I don't have a problem with that, but for some of those charges and some of those that do not require and are not involving a warning, they should be writing citations. However, my problem is when I ask for the data, okay, how many warnings did you give? They couldn't give me the data. They don't know. So I'm very frustrated in the sense, if you're going to give a warning, still, what is the data saying? How many warnings are you giving? And who are you giving these warnings to? One of the things is that we try to keep as good data as possible to make sure that we're not doing it in a negative fashion. But also, one time I hear from the police that, oh, we only have to give one warning for the 24-hour period. Then another time it's like we want to give 3-4 warnings in a 24-hour period. And that's been the frustration. There has been a number of different messages coming from BPD about what's going to go on, how do we implement this. And I just feel that we just haven't been on the same page. So, yeah, I was extremely, extremely frustrated with this entire process because you're right. I ran on that. Our team, we were able to get the courts to give us a court in three separate courthouses one day a month. We were able to get service providers.
Yeah, so it moves around, you know, from week to week. Yeah.
From every courthouse, Wabash, Patapsco, and North Avenue. We were able to get service providers. One of the things I was also very frustrated with, Monzie, we had an MOU to give services. They just signed the MOU, I think, last week, and it was sent there since June. So there was a number of things that I was extremely frustrated with. When I go to community association meetings, what people want to talk about, they just want to talk about the quality of life. This is why people are moving into Baltimore and why a lot of people are moving out of Baltimore. Crime now has come to a number of people's doorsteps in a way it hasn't. And so what are we doing to make sure that we hold people accountable, but we're trying to do it in a way that doesn't lead to mass incarceration, trying to do it in a way that's very thoughtful, and trying to get the services to individuals that need it.
Do you have a sense of how many citations you would like to have had? You know, this started in June of 2023, something like that.
Yes, sir.
I think your office told us that 88 citations were issued from the start of the program through this month in 2024, but 61 of them were rejected. I guess those are the legally insufficient ones, right?
Yes,
so
sir.
We're talking about 20 or so, you know, that
from
made
BPD.
It through. And given what other jurisdictions are doing that use this kind of approach, I mean, what should that number be, the ballpark?
Well, you know, it's hard to really say a number, because then if you focus on numbers, I think then we're looking at what some people are afraid of, the quotas. But let's look at the actions. I think when you look at some of the other jurisdictions like the Maryland Transportation Authorities, they've written a number of citations, 87, 88 during that same time period. So I think when you look at an organization such as MTA Police, 300, 400 officers, then you look at the state police, I mean, then you look at BPD, you then sit down and say, okay, if this one organization has written 80, BPD was maybe 100, 150, somewhere around there. But if you are giving a warning, just give me the data so I have a better understanding of what's working and what's not working. But if I don't have any data, then I don't really understand what's working, what's not working. Are you engaging? When I talk to the people in the neighborhood, they say they're not seeing the police engage. They're frustrated. And so their frustration has also, I think, become our frustration. Because my thing is this. If we're going to do something, and if this isn't the right thing to do, please tell me. I don't know everything. Give me something better. But until we have something better, could everybody put 100% effort in this to see if it can work?
And your beef with the mayor then is exactly what? I mean, he's not running the police department on a day-to-day basis. You've met, from what we understand, you've had meetings, your office has had meetings with the BPD. Rich Worley has said publicly that he supports the citation dockets. What could the mayor be doing?
Well, according to the mayor, he tells the police what to do. Without a doubt, if I is any problem, they're not doing anything, then I need to have come to him. And that was his concern. But once again, it wasn't just BPD. It was also Monzie as well. And both of those organizations, I felt, led to the mayor. But once again, look, a lot of miscommunication. We've moved on from that whole aspect. We're really focused on the citation docket and what the citation docket can do. I really, you know, when I go around the country and I'm on the board for the National Prosecutors Association, when I talk about the citation docket, other prosecutors around the country, they're interested in knowing, can this work? We want to move away from giving people records for quality of life crimes, but we want to go and move towards services. And most people just aren't walking the door to say, hey, give me, I'm ready to get off drugs. Most people are saying, I need a little bit of push in that direction, and where are the services?
It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. My guest today is Baltimore State's Attorney Ivan Bates. We'll have a little bit more with the state's attorney in just a bit. But first, a reminder that we are in the middle of our spring membership campaign. It is, in fact, pledge drive time, and that's because we couldn't bring you conversations like the one we're having with State's Attorney Bates without the support of listeners just like you. Because doing it ain't cheap. A pledge of $10 a month keeps the independent journalism alive. It pays for honest reporting, thoughtful analysis, news without an agenda, without hype, without spin. WYPR is committed to bringing you this kind of journalism, the kind that you have come to expect from public radio. You've already committed as a listener. Now it's time for you to commit as a sustaining member. Make your pledge right now, WYPR.org.
I'm Al Waller.
I'm Catherine Collinson.
And I'm Mihaela Vince.
In upcoming episodes of Clear Path, Your Roadmap for Life, we'll discuss ways to catch up on retirement savings and the importance of self-care. Tune in to WYPR's website and mobile app, all major podcast platforms, and transamericainstitute.org.
And welcome back to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Coming up tomorrow here on the show, our series of conversations with the candidates continues with Joe Vogel, one of 16 folks seeking the Democratic nomination for Congress in the 6th District. I'll speak with Delegate Joe Vogel tomorrow on Midday. And looking ahead to next week, on Monday, the three Democratic candidates for Baltimore City Council President, incumbent Nick Mosby, Councilman Zeke Cohen, and former Councilwoman Shannon Sneed will be my guests for a conversation about their vision for the city. And on Tuesday, we'll hold a debate with the four leading Democratic candidates for mayor, incumbent Brandon Scott, former Mayor Sheila Dixon, Tharu Vignaraja, and Bob Wallace. That debate will be held with our partners, WJZ Television and the Baltimore Banner. I'll be one of the moderators along with Denise Koch of WJZ and Emily Sullivan of the Banner. That event will be broadcast live on Tuesday during midday and on WJZ TV that night at 7 o'clock. Early voting begins a week from Thursday, May 2nd. Primary election day is May 14th. And if you've just joined us today, my guest is Ivan Bates, who was elected Baltimore State's Attorney in 2022. If you have a question or comment for our state's attorney, you can drop us an email. Our address, midday@wypr.org. So, Mr. State's Attorney, we are in the second year of a decrease in homicides and non-fatal shootings, down 44% compared to a couple of years ago. This year alone, we're at 57 murders as of today, which is a horrible number, particularly for those 57 families. But it represents 28 fewer people murdered this year than last year. And last year, that number then represented a number that was fewer than the year before. Is Baltimore safer?
You know, that's a double-edged sword in a lot of ways. In terms of some of the violent crime, we're definitely moving in the right direction. But in terms of some of the overall crime that we see, the answer to that, to me, is going to be no. When I look across, and I look at a lot of crime numbers, crime statistics, and I think with about 200-some-odd neighborhoods in the city, and I looked at a number of statistics.
278, to be exact.
And 189 of them, crime went up in 2023 as opposed to 2022. Crime went down about 38, 39, 40, and crime stayed about the same in the rest of them. The simple fact that the 189 neighborhoods crime went up is something that's really shocked me. And with that, that's why I look to say we have a long, long, long way to go.
And the kinds of crimes you're talking about,
Carjackings, burglaries, assaults, things like that. Those are the quality of life crimes and the crimes that make people want to leave. You know, this one thing when, you know, murders and violent crime, and to me, when you look at murders and violent crime, it's real easy to explain what's going on. One, we know it's a select group of individuals that do the shootings and the murders. Number one, we came out and said, hey, we're going to hold people accountable for illegal handguns. But what we've done is we've really focused on that. You know, in 2022, 98 individuals were found guilty of murder in the state's attorney's office, Baltimore City. 2023 was 136. 2022 was 60 individuals went to the federal side with guns. 2023, it was 90. So we're looking at almost 70 people are gone who were trigger pullers. Now we sit down and look at, we're calling what they call mandatory minimums in reference to the individuals who have felonies that are repeat violent offenders with guns. And we're having a lot of those individuals are now going to jail for 5 years without the possibility of parole. Now they're also gone. Then you look at ROCA, and then you may look at some of the programs that, you know, the GVRS programs. What we have done together has been absolutely amazing, but it has to start with the mentality that we are holding gun offenders accountable. And I think when we walked in the first day and said that's what we're doing, that's when you see a dramatic decrease. Now what we have to do is really have a focused effect on individual stealing cars, individual violence, what will be accepted and what won't be accepted. And that's one of the reasons, to be honest, I talked about parental accountability. Parents are the ones to be able to sit down and tell their sons, their daughters, or whomever, no, you can't go out at 2 o'clock in the morning with your friends. You got to be, you know, there are boundaries. You're going to have to be home at midnight. Because when, you know, now we're seeing, you know, you come home, you wake up in the morning, your car is stolen. Now you feel violated. You want to say crime is out of control in the city, and too many of the residents in the city are feeling that way.
Is GVRS the way to go? Mayor Scott says absolutely, positively it is. He held a press conference yesterday, which, interestingly, you were not in attendance at. I mean, you're a busy guy, but you weren't there. And the police commissioner was there. You know, others were there. But the announcement was that they're expanding GVRS to the eastern part of the city. They announced two new programs. One is a school-based violence intervention pilot project. He had hoped to get that underway much earlier. He's now going to get around to that. And a citywide parent and caregiver commission that he's forming. I mean, he's all in on GVRS. And if you're not all in on it, what does that mean for the success, the potential success of GVRS, if there isn't a complete buy-in with the state's attorney's office and the mayor's office?
Well, Tom Donnelly from my office, who's one of my number one deputies, he was there. He was very, you know, we've been very supportive with this. Now, GVRS does not focus on the types of crimes I'm talking about.
Right.
And it doesn't. And so that's my problem. We need to focus on these types of crimes here. Now, the other two I don't know anything about those programs. You know, the mayor and I haven't sat down. We haven't discussed the juvenile program. We haven't discussed any of that. And so, you know, once again, it's the communication. You know, for me, I'm here to work with whomever is going to be there. I'm going to give 100% effort. And we have given a lot of support to GVRS. I do have some concerns. I'm a little concerned that it's expanding a little too quickly with having 700 fewer officers. When I talk to the police, they're already stretched. And we're asking them for a lot of our police. And I think when you ask too much of police, that's sometime where you have some of the bad decision making because they're tired, they're stressed out, and then, boom, something negative happens. And so, you know, but at the end of the day, the mayor has sat down with the police commissioner. They've thought this through, and this is the direction they want to move, and I'm going to support that. Our office will support that. This isn't about Ivan Bates. This is about making sure we make Baltimore safer for the residents.
Ivan Bates is Baltimore City State's Attorney. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you have a question or comment for our State's Attorney, midday@wypr.org is the email address to use. And by the way, listeners, I will be speaking with Commissioner Rich Worley on Thursday here on Midday. So we'll certainly, you know, bring this up with him. But in terms of the communication, what could we be doing differently? I mean, I think you're right. The GVRS is concentrating on, you know, the real violent crimes, the murders and the non-fatal shootings. But when it comes to carjackings, when it comes to car, which is a violent crime, because most of those times are, you know, those crimes are committed with guns. Does it require a whole separate program or something? I mean, what would you like to see, and what would be best use to your office in terms of prosecuting the people who are committing these crimes?
Well, I think one of the things I do know is that I used to have, RAT, Regional Auto Theft Task Force. I would like to see a larger expansion of those to look at stolen theft cars, rings, what's going on with all of that. Also focus more on what's going on with some of the juveniles, juvenile accountability, working more closely with DJS to make sure that the young people that have been found fact sustained or have been arrested or have some connection to auto theft, that we're understanding what services they specifically need, and we're focusing specifically on those young people in terms of the car thefts. You know, are they stealing cars because it's just for joy? Are they stealing cars because they're trying to get them to an organization or a chop shop? To really have a focus on that type of behavior. You know, when I talk about parental accountability, is saying, having the parents sit down and say, hey, there are boundaries for my son or daughter. Are they in school? What's going on with truancy? I'm a real big believer that if we had more focus on the truancy in the school system, would that possibly play a better role and a bigger role in making sure our children were safer and they were focused on what they were doing? You know, I'm finding too many of these young people that have dropped out of school at such a young age. And then where is their hope? And I think, unfortunately, our young people don't have the hope that they really need to have.
You mentioned parental accountability at a press conference a couple weeks ago. Here's what you had to say to parents when it comes to their juvenile children committing some of these crimes.
Now, this message is for parents and guardians in Baltimore City, and I want you to listen closely because I'm talking to you. If you don't remember anything else about this press conference, just remember two words: parental accountability. From here on out, if you are found to be contributing to delinquency of a minor child, my office will look to charge you to hold you accountable.
Spoke with people from Center for Families and Children's in the courts at the University of Baltimore Law School last week, and they their jaws dropped when they heard you make that statement, because they say the last thing that needs to happen to parents who are under the kinds of stress that they're under in many of these cases is to further penalize them. They say that accountability is kind of code for criminalization. And if we criminalize young people, juveniles, we set them up for a life that just goes the wrong direction. It's the services that these families need, including the parents. That should be the approach. How do you respond to that?
Well, I mean, that's exactly what I said. You know, I really wish that individuals had heard the entire press conference, because I do talk about, you know, right now, Baltimore City Police Department, they catch a group of young people in a car, and DJS tells the police, take them home. I call that catch and release. I'm saying let's call it catch and assess, where the young people are taken to DJS, and DJS will say we're doing that, but we're finding out that they're really not. Somehow, once again, a miscommunication, that then they assess the needs of the young person, they assess the needs of the family. Then if this young person is sent home with their parent, and their parent has the opportunity to say they're not going to school, they're not doing this, they're not doing that, those services are there and they're going to be provided. But then let's say then that young person decides a week later to cut off their ankle bracelet, and they go and they abscond, and they're in a stolen car, and they're not going to school, but the parent has not told DJS that they've absconded, then yes, that's the parent that we could hold accountable. That's not to send anybody to jail. That tells me that parent needs maybe the parenting classes. First offense, we're always going to direct parents to parenting classes. But we need to know what services you need for your help. Everything is about help, help, help. I think what has happened, a lot of these organizations and groups, and I'm not faulting them, I don't think they've really ever dealt with a prosecutor like me, in the sense that in the past, it was the draconian sentences. Remember, I was a defense attorney, so I'm trying to find that balance. But what I also understand, parents, it has to start with you. You're the one who has to set the trend. You're the one that sets the rules in your household. If you have problems, if you have issues, what can we do to provide you the services that you need? I do not ever want to hurt a parent that's given 100%. There are some phenomenal parents. Parenting is hard. Look, you know, I'm a single parent. I'm juggling. I get it. And I need help. We need that village. And all I'm saying is, parents, I'm your enforcer to help you with that village. If you need me, I'm here. We're going to give you parenting services. We're going to use services. Whatever you need, we're here to help you with your children. I don't want your children in the criminal justice system.
Baltimore City State's Attorney Ivan Bates is my guest. We'll have more with State's Attorney Bates in a few minutes. But right now, I'd like to remind you that our spring membership campaign here at WIPR is winding down. Tomorrow is the last day that we'll be asking you to pitch in and help us meet our financial goals so that we can continue to bring you the news and information you need. You support things that make your life more meaningful. And WIPR, we hope, is one of those things. You can get your news lots of places, but to understand the meaning of what's happening, you need context. That's what you get from public radio, the information you need to make up your own mind. It's information you can trust. We can only provide it with listener support. It's the next to last day of our spring pledge drive, but there's no reason to put it off any longer. Make your pledge right now, WIPR.org. And welcome back. It's midday. If you've just joined us today, my guest is Baltimore State's Attorney Ivan Bates. If you have a question or comment for the State's Attorney, drop us an email to midday@wipr.org. And Mr. State's Attorney, we do have an email from Kim over in Pigtown who says, can you talk about the loitering laws? Is his office able to do outreach on this in the community?
Thank you so much for the email, Kim. That's where we're talking about the citation docket. One of the things that happens under the law, the police must first warn an individual, and then they have the opportunity to write them a citation. And that's how, when they would come to the citation court, then we would offer any services that they would need, but they would ask for 5 hours community service for that community. And that's one of the ways in which we're trying to go ahead and hold people accountable with no criminal history, no record, but also making sure that you make the community whole, because at the end of the day, the community is one that's suffering.
I want to play for you a clip of former federal judge and former city solicitor Andre Davis, a highly respected legal mind, a great supporter of the city, a person who wants to see violence be reduced just as badly as anybody else. He was on the show, I don't know, 3 or 4 weeks ago, and he talked about this notion of juvenile crime, because we were talking about it in the context of the bill that the General Assembly was considering at that time. They've since passed a compromise bill between the Senate and the House that you supported, that sort of filled in some blanks and made some revisions to a reform package of juvenile justice that passed the House and the Senate a couple of years ago. Here's what Judge Davis had to say about the notion of young people who break the law.
The very notion that juveniles commit crimes is itself a backslide. The entire, even before we had increased knowledge of brain science, which we have today, the whole notion going back to the 50s and even beyond the 50s, but certainly by the 60s, it was commonly understood that the whole mission of juvenile adjudications was that these young people, these juveniles, didn't commit crimes. Now, words matter. They committed offense behaviors. The word delinquent has become poisonous, admittedly, but the idea is that they weren't committing crimes in the way that we adults in the criminal justice system actually contemplate the behavior of an adult with mental capacity to form the intent and with the ability, if he or she uses it, to control their behavior in the moment. That's what we mean by criminal behavior historically.
The notion that a 11-year-old or a 12-year-old can't really commit a crime because he or she doesn't understand the notion of right and wrong. How do you respond to Judge Davis?
You know, it's funny because, you know, I had the pleasure of being in front of Judge Davis, and I remember him holding me accountable for the actions of my client when I tried to say he didn't necessarily have the mental ability to totally understand his actions. And I understand what Judge Davis is saying, but you also have to remember my job, I look at the victims, and how do I tell a victim that the 12-year-old that pull a handgun out on them didn't necessarily know what they were doing and they should just go ahead and we should act like it didn't happen? That's difficult. And I get what people say in reference to children or brain development and everything. Heck, we indicted or we charged a group of 20 juveniles between 12 and 17 for a number of offenses, 113 separate cases. I understand what people
say. A lot of those were carjackings.
Carjackings, car thefts, assaults, you know, gun violent types of alleged actions. I understand what Judge Davis is saying, but someone's got to be held accountable. At the end of the day, I'm standing up for victims to say I'm holding accountable. But what I'm also saying is when you look at that juvenile justice bill that came out of the legislature that hopefully the governor will sign, it says we're going to give more time period for services, that we're going to allow more services to understand that and to give you, the young person, what you need to stop this type of behavior. And I hear what Judge Davis is saying. I understand what he's saying. I can't necessarily always agree with what he's saying, but I understand he's looking at it to me from a perspective of what the words were saying, what they matter. What I have to do is I have to look at from the fear and the hurt of the victim having had that gun placed in their face and what that has done to them in their life.
We got to let you go in a couple of minutes, so I do want to ask you about the cold case unit that you announced just a couple of days ago. How's that going to work?
Well, basically, I'm really excited that in the past, we had Baltimore City Police Department. The cold case is a homicide, a murder that's kind of 3 years or longer from being able to, since it happened. And usually we find that very few of them are ever solved. Well, we decide in the state's attorney's office to have an experienced prosecutor who's going to be part of the team, leading the direction with the science and everything to look at a number of these cases with science in the past can hopefully try to figure out who did the crime. And then when we figure out who did the crime, develop additional evidence. We have evidence for probable cause, issue a warrant, arrest that individual, and try to bring justice to that family that lost their loved one.
One more quick question. We've talked about your relationship with the mayor and the Baltimore City Police Department. How about your relationship with the U.S. Attorney's Office, Eric Barron? Again, people talk about the importance of cooperation between the state's attorney and the federal prosecutors.
We have a great relationship. Matter of fact, we go to breakfast. Or we'll be going to breakfast again this week. We've sent a lot of cases to his office. They've been super supportive. He gives me a lot of the information that we're not able to get sometime the stateside. He's able to help us. He's been a phenomenal partner. We could not have the decrease in violent crime in our city without the partnership, not just with Eric Barron, but all our federal authorities.
Ivan Bates is the state's attorney for the city of Baltimore. Mr. Bates, always a pleasure.
Likewise.
Thank you for coming in. We'll stay in touch.
Thank you for having me. Have a good day.
That's it for us today here on Midday. Coming up tomorrow, my guest is going to be Delegate Joe Vogel. He's the youngest member of the Maryland General Assembly, and he's in a crowded field of candidates running in the 6th Congressional District for a seat in the House of Representatives. He'll join me as part of our Conversations with the Candidates series tomorrow here on Midday. So thanks to everybody who has made a pledge and become a sustaining member of WIPR during this spring membership campaign. Series like Conversations with the Candidates or Conversations with folks like the state's attorney, Ivan Bates. Shows like Midday and all of the local and national programming you hear on WIPR is made possible by listeners like you. Thanks to everybody who's become a sustaining member of our station. We really appreciate it. Make your pledge right now, WIPR.org.